Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Friday, September 15th, 2017. Glad to have you along for the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today's conversation focuses on the media, consumption habits, when to engage, even local newspapers. Your guest is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who joins us from his newsroom in New York City. Hi, David.
Hey there.
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. Let's begin with your day today, if you would. We woke up to news of another attack in London. Authorities are treating this as an act of terrorism. When something like this happens, using today as an example, are you pulling up multiple screens? Are you watching or listening or just devouring social media? How do you digest kind of a fluid event like this?
Sure. And, you know, the president took to social media to announce that it was or declare that it was terrorism at a time at which the British government was saying we're still looking into it. We presume it may be, but we don't know yet. And that tension itself was interesting to watch play out. I do follow through social media events as they play out first thing in the morning. I check email, I check social media, particularly Twitter, I find the most useful first. And I don't turn on the TV in the morning in the way that perhaps I might have done, or even Morning Edition as much, in part because I've got two kids under the age of six. So there's getting kids ready for kindergarten and preschool is usually the order of the day, and I don't really want them to hear about these things yet. That's just the sad fact. But I find that Twitter's very useful. I listen to my NPR One app incessantly, as I often, if I'm preparing things before the kids are up, which isn't always the case, if I'm traveling to and from work, I find the NPR One app gives me an incredible complement of news, particularly, and often very timely news from that morning's Morning Edition.
I do not, admittedly, have children at this point in my life. So if you're getting two kids ready to, I guess, pull the curtain back for you a little bit further at the moment, do you constantly have headphones in? Like, how are you possibly getting two little ones ready and also, following law enforcement and reporters on the ground in the UK, so on and so forth?
Well, it would be hashtag fake news if I were to say that I were doing that on my own. My wife plays an enormous part, probably bigger than I do at times, a lot of times. But when I'm on the subway, when I'm walking from drop off from school, I will definitely put in earbuds and listen. And there are times at night if I'm doing dishes and things, I'll put in my headphones or my earbuds and listen as well. Or I'll just play. I'll play on the radio and play NPR then. But I do rely. It's sort of a combination of NPR and social media and various apps. I subscribe digitally. The New York Times, the Washington Post. I read other publications as well. And through social media, I'm really being guided to hundreds of publications and news organizations across the country, and across the globe. So there's no sense in which I'm not consuming mainstream media. I'm actually getting a lot of that. I saw Theresa May talking about this morning's event in the subway in London through an interview she gave to one of the largest broadcasters in Britain. I happened to get a hold of that clip through social media, but the MSM, the mainstream media, is providing the raw content that people are serving up or riffing on online.
One early on question here in the weeds a little bit. I use TweetDeck. Do you use TweetDeck as well?
I used to,
okay.
And for no known reason, I don't now.
Okay. My question was, let me ask it this way. I guess it doesn't matter if you have TweetDeck. If you follow several hundred or several thousand people or tens of thousands of people on Twitter, in a moment like this, when you're trying to get, up-to-the-minute information, accurate information or analysis or, the positioning of law enforcement or the prime minister about, whether this is terrorism or what steps need to be taken or whether certain areas are under lockdown, how are you, I guess, pulling out the small number of Twitter followers accounts that you want to keep a particular eye on, as like the faucet of Twitter is just scrolling by your eyes?
Well, it's pretty crazy. It's a fire hose. I mean, I think many people describe it that way, but it really does feel like that. I follow far too many people. I follow more than 1,000, and I, you know, every now and then I go in and try to winnow a couple hundred, and it's tough. You know, I try to be pretty broad-gauged Catholic with a small C in my tastes and my interests. Follow things in sport and politics and culture and pop culture. Follow foreign journalists who have a different look. Follow activists, political figures. Well, not that many political figures, but people with a point of view, all of whom I hope provide something, are either provide insight, provide links to interesting things and surprising things, perhaps otherwise sources that might otherwise be obscure to me. And I try also to ensure that on the whole they tend to pass along things with appropriate caveats or of appropriate reliability so that I can rely on them not unthinkingly, but at least as a first blush pass that these are folks that aren't going to provide something from some wild-eyed commentator on Reddit, from Gateway Pundit, which has of late provided a lot of reports that have proven not to be true. As one small example, you know, of questionable import. I try to avoid the hyperventilators unless they themselves are figures I need to be aware of, and to really get people from a broad part of the country, broad, you know, interests, broad professional perspectives, broad points of view that can take me to interesting facts and insights. So I often find that as a result, I know about things before my editors do in the newsroom because, you know, I'm scrolling through this stuff. That said, a lot of them are online too. They see a lot of stuff. But, you know, you can get linked to moments that occur in Turkey, in Malaysia, in Indiana, anywhere, you know, within moments as a result of social media and the digital age in a way that for a reporter is at once blindingly distracting and awfully awfully useful.
To that point, briefly, any guilty pleasures on Twitter? And I'm thinking of like Louis C.K. to Kim Kardashian. Is there anything that professionally probably doesn't benefit you except for maybe a rare moment, but you get a kick out of it, whether it's entertainment or humor or random sports trivia or something?
I definitely follow. I'm a big Angels fan in baseball,
okay.
So I definitely follow a number of folks who cover the Angels. What do I have guilty pleasures? Sometimes I have guilty pleasures in conversations between people. There's a reporter for ESPN who has a very funny sense of humor and will often be very playful about things happening with athletes or comments made by others, and she has a really nice take on things.
Okay.
I believe her name is Mina Kimes.
Okay.
There are sometimes it's interesting to watch political professionals and reporters snipe at each other. It's something of a guilty pleasure because it's wasted energy for both. They could both probably be better spending their time serving their constituents or their audiences. But there is something gleaned about the insight you get from it, and it's also kind of, you know, for the ones who are really good at it, it can be pretty amusing.
An element of like social media voyeurism of sorts.
And at times, look, there was a guy who is, I believe, a Hollywood producer who created essentially an ongoing Twitter-length screenplay about his name's Owen Ellickson, about what Trump was doing to the campaign and how he was treating various people he would invite in and out of the campaign. And it was brutal and hilarious and in some ways insightful about what invented and imagined dialogue was. It wasn't presented as anything other than, you know, a fictionalized thing. It was screamingly funny and very rough. And at the same time, for somebody who had to cover a lot of this race and who was astonished time and again about what the candidate was willing to do, it was a very funny feed to follow.
Okay. Taking a step back to a couple of weeks ago, two major hurricanes have hit the United States. Through Harvey and Irene and all the coverage on the web, television, radio, newspapers, what stood out to you as being particularly good or particularly not so good coverage?
You know, there was some good coverage there. People were describing the threat and the aftermath and the effect of multiple hurricanes hitting, you know, along the southeast of the country, but in multiple spots. While there were some smaller islands that were hit harder than places in America, you know, the mainland part of the country were hit, including U.S. Territory that were hit that way, that didn't receive coverage instantly. You know, I thought people genuinely in major news organizations, TV in particular, took genuine effort to do some coverage. I thought it was interesting the way in which you saw administration officials, Mr. Pruitt, head of the EPA, Mr. Mulvaney, the chief budget officer for the president, tried to politicize the idea or render off bounds, shall we say, the idea that in any way climate change could be folded into this as a topic of coverage. And they said, you know, now's not the time, we've got to tend to people. And it's true. First responders have to tend to the people, and we have to think about that. And lawmakers had to allocate money to take care of them. And yet, the idea that this topic can't be broached of climate change's essentially engendering more erratic and more extreme weather episodes, you know, it seems to say that journalists can't do it. Well, journalists have to do things responsibly, but I think they have a job to bring it, you know, to simply say, well, we've got to deal with these effects and not think about things that have been scientifically connected with the creation of these events would, to my mind, be a kind of dereliction of duty. Mm-hmm. So there are ways in which we're thinking about hurricane coverage differently than simply the, are they, you know, is local news just scaring the bejesus out of us, right?
Right.
And there are some implications now about how journalism is done, which says, well, are they being, you know, are they using drones? Are they interfering with efforts to monitor and remedy the circumstances? Are we dealing with issues like climate change? Are the and a perennial that's been the case ever since viewers older than I am certainly first saw Dan Rather, you know, essentially lash himself to a lamppost to cover one of these things in the early 1960s.
Right.
You know, are these guys putting themselves in harm's way? And is the immediacy of the technology encouraging them to do so? And I do think at a certain point, yes, by tramping around in the middle of flooded streets or where gale force winds are whipping through, they show us the power of the storm. There's a lot of risks being taken that I don't think are necessary and I think are somewhat troubling.
So there's that
element as well.
Thinking about that, hurricanes are obviously such a visual story and radio is such not a visual medium. I think in some ways that lends itself to explore other doors and for radio, specifically public radio, to not be sensational necessarily. I mean, to talk to some of the people on the ground and provide, I guess, more information and context than maybe tying yourself to a utility pole or something like that. Thinking about radio as it covers hurricanes, and obviously the way that NPR and public radio member stations have covered hurricanes in your time in the media has changed drastically because, you know, the proliferation of websites and whatnot. How do you think radio does with hurricanes? Are there areas, you know, are there stones uncovered that, you know, as you look at the scope of coverage of natural disasters, things that are so visual that radio can improve upon or continue to do more of?
You know, one of the things the radio does best is it transports people to a place, and you could hear the winds whipping, and that kind of takes you there. But we're also pretty good at allowing people to tell their own stories and their own experiences, not because anecdote trumps fact or data, but because it helps to give texture to what people actually experience and remind you that people are not numbers. And I think that when radio is at its best, even in seemingly visual stories like these, we knit together, shall we say, hard journalism with narrative and with stories and with people speaking in their own voices. It's one of the things I like best about what we do and treating them with civility and not simply as a victim, not simply as someone something happened to, but a person whose life and experiences are worth acknowledging and perhaps dropping in on for a moment in a respectful but journalistically sound way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of those stories are great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. For you day to day, what are your consumption habits? What's your routine in terms of keeping up with everything that's going on?
Well, sometimes I get credit for doing too much. Sometimes social media alerts me to things after the fact. I just don't have the bandwidth to watch as much TV as I did.
Sure.
In part because of the kids, but also because so much of our time is spent in front of these other screens that you know, these pixels in front of us that bring us all this other information. So I tend to read a few papers online each day. I get the hard copy of the Times still a few days a week. I tend to read the Washington Post, the LA Times. I'm from Southern California. You know, I certainly like keeping tabs on what my old friends in the Triangle are up to.
Mm-hmm.
I will read The Guardian and The Telegraph and some places in London because, in part because there are times where British media stories become newsworthy here. And because I'm interested in seeing what's happening abroad and seeing if there are patterns or rhythms or events that are playing out ahead of them playing out here or maybe just playing out in different ways. You know, by following Brexit and that debate, I had more insight into what was happening with the campaign of Donald Trump than I otherwise would have.
When do you unplug, if ever? Like really unplug? I'm not saying like don't watch TV for a couple of days, but like put the cell phone away and don't look at it for a day or two.
I try to put the cell phone away when I get home. I'm successful sometimes more than others. This week, not so much. I try to on weekends not check there. You know, I took Facebook as an app off my phone, so that forces me to consciously type in Facebook.com in my little web browser, and that has meant I just visit it a lot less, and so I just do a lot less with it, and I'm okay with that. And periodically, I do that with Twitter as well, where it just the very fact of uninstalling the app forces a discipline on you that if you want to do it, you got to be more conscious. You can't just swipe and tap your thumb. And that's probably useful as well. But I would say that it's been a this summer, I will say I took 2 weeks off non-consecutively. And for the first time, I didn't file any stories from vacation. And I felt very good about that.
That's good. That's very good.
It's been very intense. I would say from August 2015 on, this has been a very intense news time. That Trump really has changed even more than before the rhythms and the circadian rhythms.
Right.
It just doesn't feel like it's stopping. And, you know, media and politics can seem like a complementary or auxiliary beat. But when you've got a guy at the head of government who got 100% name recognition by virtue not of his claimed business ventures or real estate, but by being a reality TV show star and an executive producer, he cares about TV as much or more than anything else that's going on. So suddenly media is the story.
And this is undeniably a historically quiet time. And you talk about the circadian rhythm of news. August 15th and, you know, into the start of the school year in mid-September, this is usually a pretty quiet time, right? I mean, is this the busiest August 15th to September 15th that you've ever had?
It feels like it. I'm sure that, you know, there must have been a time where I could go back and do it. But usually August is a known dead period, particularly after an election. You know,
right.
Maybe building up toward one.
Right,
intense,
right. That's
after
fair.
The election is supposed to be a time where everybody takes a breath, licks their wounds, you know, meets with friend and knits, you know, their bones where they've had problems. And this has been a full sprint. But, you know, let's be clear, we're in a time, if you think back to the first few months of the year, of in some ways self-induced crisis. You know, the economy was puttering along pretty decently, not brilliantly, still a lot of concern and pain out there, but it was doing fine. There was a retrenchment and diminishment of the amount of a conflict that American forces were serving in. There wasn't any great crisis that the government had to step into. There wasn't a 9/11. There wasn't the financial collapse that preceded Obama taking over. There weren't, you know, it was more like is even in better shape than when Clinton took office, you know, where things maybe were starting to improve a little bit, but there had been a real recession at that point. And the Trump administration decided to radically or significantly change policies, which they're entitled to do, and to change things in ways that the court said in certain circumstances they were not entitled to do. And it created a sense of crisis and a sense of intensity and a sense of movement and momentum and tumult that might not have been determined or dictated by outside circumstances.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is the guest here on the WUNC Politics podcast. As we talk about President Trump and this administration, I'm wondering how you view the current adversarial relationship between this White House and the press. And I guess what I want to get at is who you think has the upper hand at this point. If Trump really is, if President Trump is manipulating and really driving the conversation and the messaging that, you know, in turn is what news major news stations are covering, the mainstream media, or are we at a point now where reporters, journalists are just more readily getting under his skin? And maybe you view it totally differently, but what do you make of where things stand presently, it's fluid, of this relationship?
I think it's pretty interesting that the president, with everything that's going on, with the deals that he struck with Democratic officials from Congress in the last 10 days, you know, went out of his way to attack one of the hosts on ESPN who had been starkly critical of him. She used some pretty strong words. You could argue it was an ad hominem attack. She called him a white supremacist. She's African-American herself, and there are things that she can point to in over the course of the decades that he has said that certainly are either racially insensitive, racially incendiary, or racist, you can argue. But it's a strong thing to hear from a host on ESPN who has such a pulpit herself. But the fact that he then denounced her on Twitter, the fact that his formal official press secretary called what she did a firing offense, you know, gives you a feel for the importance that Trump attaches to television. Although she made her remarks on Twitter, I believe, on social media, it right. gives you a feel for the offense and the quickness of offense that the president takes when people criticize him strongly, despite his willingness to criticize others strongly, both before and after taking the presidency. And it also gives you a feel for the back and forth with the media, which is front of mind for him. You know, there's nobody who wants the approval of the media more than Donald Trump. It's not that he hates the media, it's that he hates the media for not loving him. And so, you know, what he wants most is respect from 60 Minutes and the Today Show and cover stories on the New York Times Magazine. He wants to be praised on Morning Joe on MSNBC and seen as a serious thinker, you know, on the Sunday shows. And when figures in journalism fail to give him that kind of reverential treatment, he lashes out. You know, he's looking for constant praise from the press. That is not a – I'm not slapping him there. That's just proven by a mountain of evidence and proven again on a daily basis. So, you know, it's not that he hates the press. He's really wounded and hurt that the press doesn't regard him with the respect and affinity that he thinks he should get.
Right.
And so that's sort of how I view this. And mm-hmm. so he personalizes his relationships. You see that in his tweets. Again, it's people who have criticized him. You see not only did he call, Crooked Hillary was his moniker for Hillary Clinton. Well, he says failing New York Times. He calls the Washington Post the Jeff Bezos Post or the Amazon Post to remind people that it's personally owned by Jeff Bezos, the head of and founder of Amazon, and he views everything they report in light of what Amazon, you know, may want to be doing in a business sense or in a regulatory sense. That's not a completely illegitimate point to make, but it's not a substantive response to a lot of the incredibly valid issues that the Post has raised in its very vigorous, muscular reporting.
Right. It is rare that he attacks ideas or positions. It's much, I mean, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I'm sure he has at times, but it is generally a one-to-one, or I mean, I guess it can be an institutional thing, but I haven't heard him attack policies or you know, dissect a policy or a piece of legislation for what's wrong with it, right? Sticking with Jemele Hill, the ESPN analyst who is at the center of this controversy this week, who made these comments on social media about the president, did this get too much attention? Is it a signal of just the era we live in?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think the fact that somebody—I mean, there was this great term from the comic strip Bloom County many years ago,
okay,
where they coined this. He coined that Burke Breathed, the writer there. I used to love that comic strip. He and I think he still does it online, but now. But there was this phrase he coined that was, I think, called offense sensitivity. And that was the blended idea that people were exceptionally sensitive to everything and would take great offense at the drop of the hat. And
welcome to 2017, right?
Right. That's kind of the social media moment we're in, where it's just like, oh my gosh, somebody said this really upsetting thing, and I'm deciding to treat it as though it is the end of the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, the press has to be careful not to do that to Trump, and not to, and not to treat everything, every utterance of him, by him, or people speaking or working on his behalf about the press as a clampdown and the equivalent of throwing people in jail, because it's not. I think perspective has to be regained, and that reporters and journalists and news organizations have to take the lead in offering perspective and balance. Twitter does not fuel balance.
Right.
Twitter fuels outrage, and it fuels instant reaction, and you know, we might all be better served if there were a little screen on Twitter after you type something and hit tweet or send or whatever the heck it is, a little screen came forward and said, "Are you sure?" And you had to click another little thing that said, "Yeah, I'm sure." But that's not the way it works. And so, you know, you see Jemele Hill's caustic, severe remarks about the president divide people into camps, and you see it folding into a larger narrative fueled by, sort of professional cultural conservatives, the Breitbarts of the world, that somehow ESPN is a right-wing organization, or excuse me, a left-wing organization, which I can tell you from talking to folks there is not really the case.
Yeah.
But they are acknowledging the intersection of sport and politics more explicitly than might have been done decades ago. And you know, for that matter, sport, popular culture, sport, and broader society. So I think that it tends to absorb the oxygen in the room for what policies are being made, what regulations are put in place, what treaties are being enforced or abandoned, what appointments are being made, the kinds of contracts are given, the kinds of warp and woof of what the government actually does that really will ultimately affect the lives of Americans far more greatly.
Kind of pivoting from the Jemele Hill situation, and I thought of this again this week, candidly, one of the things I think I struggle with as a reporter, a political reporter in North Carolina, is when to ignore, what to ignore, how to give proper deference to certain things that, I mean, in my opinion, and maybe I'm showing too many of my cards here, I think this, as you just articulated well, this is a sign of the times. This doesn't need to get as much attention as it did. I mean, Jemele Hill is not a political expert or a pundit. I mean, it seems like this just kind of took off. But going back to the point of ignoring, or if we should ignore more or when to ignore, do you have a framework in your head about when reporters should be, dismissing or just moving on to the next thing? When should we be ignoring?
Look, I think that it would be good from my perspective, and this is not uniformly shared, if reporters and media figures were a bit more circumspect at times about how they expressed their thinking about things. And I think it would be good if people were a little more circumspect about treating it as though it's a Reichstag fire, as though that it's each instance of this is a disaster. I also think she's entitled to her opinion. And
of course,
the wrinkle is that she has such a platform in being a host on, I think it's called SportsCenter 6, that allows her also to offer her analysis and opinions on things that, you know, it seems to me understandable that people in positions like that and like mine calibrate how much of their own sort of straight personal belief they infuse into those programs because of the platform they have. I will say journalism has been moving for the past 20 years, I think fueled by cable and fueled by online norms that have been evolving. The journalism itself has been moving more into an emphasis of fairness over, you know, supposed impartiality or objectivity. That is, that we don't expect people to come with no thoughts in their head to every story. We understand people have a worldview or have a point of view on something or have thought about something before, and that that's okay. But, you know, and her remarks were not incidental. They came, if I remember the timing correctly, after Tim Scott of South Carolina, you know, African-American Republican senator, had emerged from a meeting at, with the president at the White House at which they talked about Charlottesville and race, and Scott was able to talk about the importance of that afterward about of that meeting. And then Trump came out and said, you know, it still is important to note there were good people on both, you know, there were good people on both sides of those protests. And it seemed as though Trump willingly re-entered those waters that caused him so much almost uniform condemnation.
Right. Bad people on both sides of those waters, right?
Yeah, well, I think he said...
Or did he say good people?
Bad people.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, I think that, you know, it seemed to, put it this way, at minimum, seemed to equate the protesters of essentially white, you know, racist...
right, the white supremacists and the... Yeah.
With those who were protesting against it. And that would seem to be a problem. So she, you know, took affront. And the question is, what you do with that affront? Do you speak out? There are news organizations where people have clear points of view and yet journalistically seem to work hard to be fair-minded to facts that come into play that might cut against a policy you might otherwise agree with or a position that you might otherwise agree with. And that's the intellectual honesty I tend to look for in journalism. ESPN is a place that wants to reach people of all stripes, all beliefs, all backgrounds, and through sport, it is, and its reporting, it's now reflecting, I think, perhaps a greater window on the world, using sport as a vehicle to do that at times. And some viewers don't want that. Some viewers want them to focus more on X's and O's, and I understand that. It seems to me that if you're given that platform to reach people to talk about sport and society and at times race and culture and politics, that, you know, you then have to figure out how much you want to calibrate how strongly you speak on certain things. This, for her, was clearly something she felt she wanted to speak up on. It was notable to me that she didn't apologize for not only her views but for expressing them, but she apologized for expressing them in a way that brought, you know, reproach to ESPN.
Right. And she has not been punished to this point, at least that we're aware of. And it doesn't seem as though a punishment of any in any public nature or of significance is coming down the pipe, but it's perhaps too early to say that definitively.
It doesn't look like that. I mean, it could have consequences down the line
right.
In terms of a relationship with the network, but they seem to be working through it. They seem to be trying to figure it out. It does not seem to me like they had a little six-page brochure on how they wanted, or manual on how they want to deal with this they had in their second desk drawer. They pulled it out and played it. This was
right. You
know, being thought through in real time.
Right. That is the voice of David Folkenflik. He is an NPR media correspondent, the NPR media correspondent, who is chatting with us from New York City. David, you used to spend your days here in Durham. You were a reporter for the Herald Sun. I didn't know that until I did a little research on you. What did you cover? What was your beat down here?
So I got out of college in 1991, and you know, I'd been a student editor and thought, hey, you know, I'm gonna really be able to knock the world down. And it took me, I think, 70 job applications before I hit on the Herald Sun, and I could not have been luckier to get it. I covered higher education, which seems to me to be the, you know, one of the best beats in the state by far. It's just such an interesting thing. I covered Duke, but also some other higher ed stuff, and I felt like here was a community of, I don't remember the numbers anymore, but let's say 40,000, maybe fewer, but when you include employees, it's one of the biggest employers of the state. It was, you know, as with UNC and NC Central and State and Davidson, Wake Forest, and a lot of other campuses in North Carolina, it's, you know, a real center of intellectual ferment. It's a place where a lot of issues like gays in the military and healthcare for reform and other things played out before they played out in larger society. And it was just interesting. You know, my feeling was that there was just such life there. It was much more interesting there than just hanging around a newsroom. You know, you're just, you have an excuse to knock on doors and ask interesting people about their lives and their interests. And it was a way to cover community. It was a way to cover controversy, but it was also a way at times to say, look, for people who whose kids were about to apply to school, for people who were alums, for people who never got the chance to go to college, it was a way to take them inside the classroom at time. So interesting. People were so generous at Duke with their time. And I found such a warm reception in Durham. I just loved it. And it hooked me on just reporting. The editors there, a guy named Bill Hawkins, Bill Stagg, John Hamm were there, and they were happy to exploit my eagerness and the eagerness of others there. Ernie Suggs, now at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, was a reporter with me. A lot of friends still live there, and it's just a great opportunity to shoot out of the gate and have a lot of fun reporting on what was, I thought, a very engaged readership at that time. You know, they really, you know, they followed what you reported, and if you got something a little wrong, they sure as heck let you know. That was a good lesson, too.
Yeah, for sure. You've been back here several times since those days. The city itself, particularly downtown, as we've seen with the urbanization across the country, the downtown here in Durham has changed very much since you came here 25, 26
awesome.
Years ago. What are a couple, two, three, four, however many you want to touch on, what are some places that when you do come back, you just have to go to in Durham? If there are any must stop at places.
Well, I do like to try to stop by and take a drive through or a walk through or run through Duke. I just always enjoy doing that. Sometimes I'd run from Duke Chapel, the East Campus, around the old campus and back. Sometimes I'd do it behind the golf course there. I love where you guys are situated. I love taking in ball games. I haven't been to the Triple A Bulls Park, but I have warm memories of the old one, and I love just walking around the new stadium.
Cool.
You know, my God, you got these great, like, artisanal donut shops. You got these downtown pizzerias and bookstores downtown. You know, and I love the rooftop. There's the hotel that's got
Hotel Durham. Yep.
Yeah, it's just marvelous experience there. And it's been great, like, great eating. Like, the whole thing is great. So, I would have been delighted to have that there when I was there, but it didn't occur to me such things were possible.
Final one from me, and I appreciate the time. I've kept you longer than expected. You also spent a decade at the Baltimore Sun before going to work for NPR. I'm going to presume that you've watched The Wire and that you've watched all of it. So I'm wondering what your favorite season of The Wire was. Of course, The Wire was set in Baltimore, and why. And if you haven't watched The Wire, it's just going to be really sad.
Yeah, no, I watched The Wire.
Okay, all right.
Very funny. David Simon was the man behind it. He was a colleague of mine in Baltimore, just a brilliant, dazzling reporter, producer, visionary, and just personality. Just such a larger-than-life character himself behind the camera. You know, it's funny, they filmed the last season was about the Baltimore Sun as much as anything else. And they took an old grocery store over in Columbia, Maryland, outside Baltimore, and recreated the Sun's newsroom. David, I went down to do a story on it for NPR. David graciously took me on a tour of the studio and let me sit in on some filming. And he pointed out with great pride the verisimilitude that touches the documents that were in boxes that were under a desk that were brought in by Bill Zorzi, a former colleague of ours who covered the state capitol, and they were actually documents from his old basement. You know, they were the real thing. The font on the name cards were the right. And at one point, David pointed out a photograph, and he said, oh, here I am. You know, I mean, these are all these little touches in a set that viewers will never be able to see because the camera's not going to linger on.
Right.
But, you know, it creates the real texture of it. So he points this photograph up in a cubicle, and it's he's like, look, there I am, meaning David, is in Rafael Alvarez's going away party. Here's that skit I did. And I said, David, you're right. And there I am, standing right next to you in that photograph. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's you.
That's neat.
And so, you know, it just happened to stumble by it. These were old friends who did just tremendous work on that series. It was you know, it was often fun, sometimes painful to see episodes that, you know, I knew the backstory to come to life in a slightly fictionalized way. But what David did was, of course, transcend that and make this about our society and how it works and how it often doesn't work. A combination of cynicism, apathy, and people sometimes missing the point that, you know, are at the heart not only of the great journalism that people did at The Sun and try to do every day here at NPR, but that are accomplished through art that's as impressive as his.
Season 4 was my favorite, the one about the schools and the children. Did you have...
You know, I thought that was dazzling. Yeah. I got to say, the first one was in some ways the toughest and the most impressive one. It mm-hmm. was, you know, because it focused so squarely on the drug trade and on poverty, it was very tough, but it was astonishing. I thought that the Ports, what am I going to say? I thought the Ports was good. And the, when they over, you know, the thing about season 3 is they then just overlaid the politics over over the working class port, over
right.
the you know, the public housing and the way drug trade really insidiously undermined that. Yeah, in some ways, Schools was the best, in part because it's unlike anything you've ever seen. Like, nobody touches Schools on
right.
TV because it's not compelling television, and yet they made it very human and the stakes very real.
If you haven't watched The Wire, you should watch The Wire. You should start it this weekend wherever you are. David Folkenflik from NPR, media correspondent, thank you for coming on the podcast.
You bet. My great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And as always, thank you for tuning in. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Leave us a rating there as well. The editors do appreciate that. We will chat with you again next week. Thanks for clicking play on the WNC Politics Podcast.
We just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.